From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, Time Magazine and People Weekly featured big stories on a missing person. Newsweek did it last week, and the cable news shows and the tabloids are doing it all the time. The case of missing Washington intern Chandra Levy inevitably reminds us of the biggest cable news story of the last decade, Monica Lewinsky. Both cases involve an intern and an elected official who uses evasive language to describe the relationship. But Levy's case also brings to mind another huge tabloid story, JonBenet Ramsey. And playing the role originated by the Ramsey parents is California Congressman Gary Condit, self-described good friend of the missing 24-year-old.
Meanwhile, police would like to hear more details from Representative Gary Condit. Investigators plan to interview the congressman tonight to clear up certain facts he did not share with them in his first interview regarding Chandra's disappearance. For instance, police learned from the media that Condit's wife had been in Washington, D.C. during that crucial period when Chandra disappeared.
It's good that police are learning anything from the media, because the media have a hard time learning many lessons on their own. No matter how much criticism cable news gets for turning stories like O.J. and JonBenet into freak shows, it inevitably goes into full carnival barker mode at every opportunity.
Cable news is demanding, not of its viewers, but of its subjects. It's not enough for a story to be lurid or tragic. Cable news stories have to come with a raft of unanswered questions to be discussed by a flotilla of experts who float their wild guesses with an air of authority. Last week, the Fox News Channel turned to the unsinkable Robert Shapiro, OJ attorney and tabloid story veteran. CNN's The Point with Greta Van Susteren was typical of the sort of questions we got on cable news.
Well, you know, it's probably grossly unfair to this congressman. There's an awful lot of attention on him. At this point, we simply don't know, but the relationship does at least appear bizarre.
Unfair to the congressman, but it was a bizarre relationship. Van Susteren seemed to have a hard time reconciling her current role as newscaster with her former role as prosecutor.
But what about the paging? The calls from her phone to his pager, certainly at least up until the point where she's last accounted for, seems unusual, bizarre.
Bizarre but not unusual would be a good description of the news outlets covering the Chandra Levy case. If Gary Condit had nothing to do with Levy's disappearance, the media owe the congressman a Richard Jewell-sized apology. And even if he did, they owe us all back those few minutes of our lives when they used our television to broadcast stuff like the following. Here's Fox's coverage of a press conference given by Billy Martin, the lawyer for Chandra Levy's parents.
Senior correspondent Rita Cosby. Rita, we all heard the facts of what Billy Martin was saying, but I guess the most important thing is to get a reporter's sense of what he was also not saying and hinting at.
While you're at it, how about a clairvoyant sense of what he was thinking? How about a beautician's sense of the tonsorial message being communicated by his haircut?
We all heard the facts.
Facts, facts, facts. Who needs facts? Hints will be fine. Speculation, even better. MSNBC's Nora O'Donnell knows the drill.
When the question was asked of the attorney and the family, why hire former homicide investigators to help you out, it was then that Dr. and Mrs. Levy were holding hands and then removed their hands from one another and embraced one another. It was clear emotionally that they have reached a different point and they realize that this case needs to move forward. It was almost as if they knew something that we don't know yet.
Since the beginning of the year, in Washington, D.C. alone, more than 500 people who have gone missing are still gone. Many leave behind grieving family and friends. It is all but impossible for the missing persons who don't have any media-friendly traits like connections to congressmen to get a fraction of the attention that Chandra Levy has been getting. Even with 24-hour news, there's simply not enough time. The British media are engaged in an extended orgy of their own as they await the release of John Venables and Robert Thompson after 8 years in prison. They are 18 now, but they were 10 when they lured a toddler named James Bulger from a shopping mall near Liverpool, beat him to death, and left his body on a railroad track. This week, their parole board announced the boys will be furnished with new names and identities and released, but it can be argued they will not be free. The reason has everything to do with new political realities, an increasingly competitive press, and the all-important availability of pictures. Richard Ford of the Times of London joins us now. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
So, are pictures of the perpetrators floating around?
There is a rumor, and it is no more than a rumor, that a picture of one of the boys is circulating. It has allegedly been shown to a TV reporter, but no one else has seen it.
And when that TV reporter was shown holding the picture on a news program, even though he held it away from the cameras, the Attorney General was so concerned that he reminded the media to act responsibly. Is he asking journalists to regulate themselves?
Well, I think what he was doing was, we know that the hearings are taking place on whether the boys should be released, and the frenzy is building up, and I think he was just reminding us that there is an injunction, a lifelong ban on us identifying or doing anything that can allow these children to be identified or their whereabouts known. I think his real problem is not with the newspapers. I think his problem is with the internet, because I don't understand how he's going to be able to stop stuff appearing on the internet.
Now, the British tabloids aren't exactly known for their restraint when it comes to invasions of privacy. We had a reminder of that recently when Sophie Windsor was tricked into an embarrassing expose by the News of the World. If the News of the World or the Express or the Daily Mail get hold of the pictures of the boys, knowing that they would be in contravention of the injunction and knowing that they could potentially put those boys in harm's way, would they go ahead and print them, do you think?
My feeling is they wouldn't. I mean, it's a very different thing from doing a sting on Sophie Windsor to publishing pictures of two youths, which could lead to their whereabouts being discovered, and let's be blunt about it, could lead to injury and even death. Public opinion might not like what is going on with those boys if they do come out, but public opinion would switch very quickly if the media could be seen to have helped lead a mob to their door. I think most newspaper editors wouldn't touch it.
The public reaction to the release of Venables and Thompson, as you say in your article, at times borders on hysteria. What part has the media played in fanning those flames?
The one thing that everybody remarks upon is that video picture of James in the Bootle shopping centre with the two boys. You just see the little boy and the two boys beckoning him away. Of course, it's endlessly replayed, and I think it just sticks in everybody's mind. I mean, the number of people who say that video has made all the difference.
Now, Nathaniel Brazil, the 14-year-old in Florida who shot his teacher and was sentenced to life imprisonment here, was caught on camera minutes before he pulled the trigger, and that image was played over and over again. You quoted a lawyer with regard to the closed-circuit TV image of James Bulger's abduction. He said that that image touched a nerve with the public and still does. What does it say about the new media landscape that this tape can be played over and over again?
That video, that's part of it, but I think the new media landscape is much more the total access, the way media is such a powerful cultural tool now, in a way that it never was before. And I think it's the fact that the image is played, people look at it and say, God, wasn't it awful? And then they're on the phone in programs, and it's the round-the-clock broadcasting, and everybody has a view. It doesn't matter whether that view is right, wrong, or even, you know, you can hear views from people, and as a journalist you can say, well, it's just complete nonsense, but they're on the telly saying it, and it's essentially this is the era in which the ordinary man and woman can have their say, and it's as valid as the experts.
How does the media driven debate affect the treatment of Venables and Thompson?
Well, I think it demonizes them. You know, they are made out to be monsters, and I think the argument that they were children when they committed this, and that surely a child can change and can develop, is very difficult to get over when you've got, on the one hand, these two boys, you know, what they did was the most appalling brutality. And then on the other side, you've got James's mother saying, don't forget me. And it just fuels an incredible appeal to emotion rather than to reason.
Richard Ford, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Richard Ford is a writer for the Times of London.
We're interested in your thoughts on all this. Sometimes a tabloid story is worthy of all the attention it gets. Sometimes it's merely sensationalism for the sake of grabbing eyeballs. Tell us what makes a tabloid-type story worth your time, and don't ignore the human factor, the stories that interest us just because they're interesting. Visit our website at onthemedia.org. Look for the heading that says The Big Idea and send in your comments and suggestions. You can also get free transcripts for all our stories and find links related to the stories we cover. And if you think there's something we're not covering, email us with your ideas and story pitches at onthemedia@wnyc.org.
While we're on the subject, let's read a few of your letters. After our interview with White House Press Secretary Ari Fleischer concerning questions he received about the underage drinking of Jenna Bush, Darren Carter of New York wrote, "Ari Fleischer's inability to deal appropriately with questions from the press on this issue concerns me deeply. No one cares what transpires between your daughter and yourself other than your immediate family. However, when events that happen to your family have political implications for stances that you take as president, these events are newsworthy. The world is focused on you and your family, and when your family's behaviors are not in line with your political rhetoric, we want to know."
After a media witness to the McVeigh execution told us that she didn't think airing it would make much difference because of its clinical quality, Eric Hamill of Philadelphia was moved to respond. "I think it depends on who's being executed and why. McVeigh never denied his crime and accepted the death sentence. On the other hand, Shaka Sankofa, killed in Texas last summer, continued to resist and proclaim his innocence to the end. Seeing that might have had quite an impact on people."
And this from Virginia Ekman. "Mine will not be the only email you receive," she's right, it wasn't, "to correct the error in a listener letter about a multinational production of Don Carlos. The opera was composed," she writes, "not by Mozart, but by Verdi, and some opera lovers believe it was his greatest. I hope you will give Verdi his due with a correction, especially as this is the Verdi centennial year being celebrated all over the world." Virginia, I think we can do a little better than that. Coming up, an Hispanic broadcaster says he was done in by politicians. Also, a look back on 50 years of color TV and ahead to the end of the BBC's North American broadcasts on shortwave.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The popular host of a Spanish news talk show called Under Fire says three New York members of Congress used their political power to suppress his political views. Herson Barrero was fired days after his station managers and a representative of the parent company, the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation, held a meeting with the elected officials. Barrero says they threatened to prevent the station from renewing its broadcasting license if he didn't tone down his drive-time show on WADOAM, or WADO. As On the Media as Marianne McCune reports, Herson Barrero chose not to comply.
The way media works in my community is that they're very respectful. They get an interview on radio or on television, and they're like, oh, thank you, Mr. Congressman. Thank you, Ms. Congresswoman. You know, and it's kissing. You know, it's disgusting.
If Herson Borrero doesn't get what he considers an honest answer from a politician, he calls him a culipandero, one who sways from side to side. If he believes Congressman Jose Serrano of the Bronx isn't taking a clear stance on the status of Puerto Rico, Borrero accuses him of lacking political testicles. New York Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez has no political ovaries.
I think that that's an appropriate choice of words.
Well, I don't think it's the job of journalists to talk about people's body parts.
That's Congressman Robert Menendez of New Jersey, who, along with Jose Serrano and Nydia Velazquez, met with station brass. He's one more among dozens of targets Borrero has aimed at, both from his perch as editor-in-chief of the popular Spanish-language newspaper El Diario La Prensa and from behind his Wado microphone.
Wado used to be called La Campeona, which in Spanish means the champion, and it was the champion of the Hispanic community. It promoted its interests, it promoted its unity, and we believe that it's no longer La Campeona. It lost its way.
Congressman Menendez says Borrero is divisive, that he looks to pit one group of Hispanics against another. Borrero once slammed the first ever Puerto Rican congressman as an ex-Puerto Rican, but that congressman, now New York mayoral candidate Herman Badillo, doesn't flinch. He says the Hispanic community can handle internal debate.
I have every confidence that the Hispanic community can discern what is good and what is not good for the community. That is the nature of the reporting process. That's why we have the kind of radio programs we do, so that people can decide what they believe is good for the community.
Borrero believes the thousands of new listeners he's attracted to Wado are deciding he's right. And that's why Congress members want him off the air.
So instead of saying, I will never be on his program, I will never listen to him, they're saying, get him off the air or I'm going to mess with your licensing. That is, to me, that is corrupt. That is dictatorial. It's tyrannical. It is not a democracy then, if we allow them to do this.
Actually, that does happen in a democracy, says Jane Kirtley, professor of media ethics and law at University of Minnesota. Whether or not the details of this particular story are as Borrero describes.
I think the only thing that's really surprising about this is the fact that this kind of thing doesn't happen more often.
Broadcast media are regulated by the Federal Communications Commission, and although the FCC is supposed to be impervious to political pressure, she says Congress can and does get involved. Elected officials lobby commission members. They file letters of complaint or support, and they also act preemptively by stating their positions to heads of media outlets.
I think it would be appropriate for members of Congress to resist, but I think human nature is such that if you have power, it takes a pretty big, strong, tall person to resist the impulse to do that.
Jane Kirtley, like Herson Borrero, believes it's up to broadcasters to stand up for themselves.
I was so incensed that they would sit there and be subjected to verbal insults and threats, which I think constitute a corrupt act on the part of these three elected officials who are looking out for their self-interest.
But what if that's not exactly the way it happened? Congressman Menendez says Wado called the meeting to ask for his and his colleague's stamp of approval on a new programming idea.
If you come to me and you ask me to support programming at your initiative, and I tell you no, and you ask me why, and I tell you why I won't support it, then I think that's certainly proper. And that's the nature of the circumstances that took place here.
Certainly, I don't have any problem with them saying, we don't like what you're doing.
As long as it's not couched in a retaliatory threat, says Professor Jane Kirtley.
You know, we don't like what you're doing, and by the way, we're members of Congress, and by the way, we may have some input into your license renewal, so it would be good for you, wise of you, to stay on our good side. I mean, that is obviously a more subtle form, I suppose, of censorship.
Did you say we may not support the renewal of your license in 2006?
I don't recall specifically saying that. I do recall saying that, you know, we are free, as is the constituency we represent, to consider raising our concerns at any given point in time, both with the station and in the future should they go ahead and, have a licensing process.
Watto representatives passed on some version of that message to Herson Barrero, and when Barrero made it clear he planned to tell his listeners all about it, he says they fired him. None of the Watto representatives present at the meeting have returned repeated phone calls. They have only released a statement saying the Hispanic Broadcasting Corporation does not comment on situations, relations, internal matters, or negotiations with employees and or former employees. For On the Media, I'm Marianne McCune in New York.
The World Service of the British Broadcasting Corporation has set the standard for international shortwave stations for some 70 years. It's long famous for fair and balanced news coverage and respected for the wall it's tried to build between its editorial mission and its funder, the British government. Until recently, shortwave radio, with its long reach but low fidelity, was the main way the BBC World Service reached its vast audience. But earlier this month, it broadcast a message that signaled the beginning of the end of an era. It announced that it would end shortwave transmissions aimed towards North America, Australia, and New Zealand in favor of rebroadcasts on FM and live streaming via the Internet. David Gorin has this story.
Shortly before 6 p.m. Eastern Time, North American shortwave listeners are tuning into BBC World Service relay transmitters. They're waiting for the bells.
This is the BBC in London, bringing you the latest news reports and business updates from around the world. BBC World Service, news 24 hours a day.
Since 1932, the BBC World Service has beamed its programs worldwide over the shortwave bands. Each week, 153 million people tune in for a different perspective on the news.
Oklahoma bomber Timothy McVeigh is finally executed, drawing international condemnation but American delight.
I feel so great. Just so glad that he is dead. He's gone. He hurt nobody else. He deserved what he got.
I would listen to the Voice of America and hear the news at the top of the hour. And then I'd listen to the BBC news at the top of the hour. It was like listening to a whole different planet.
Don Mussel has been listening to the BBC and other international broadcasters since the early 1960s.
The angle from which they came to the news seemed fairly well balanced, almost sitting back and observing, saying, well, over here they're doing this, and over there they're doing that. in sort of I don't want to say disconnected, but they were sort of aloof, perhaps. Didn't seem like they were taking any advocacy one way or the other, And I know that that was important to them. I think that's the image that they wanted to project.
BBC On Air magazine is your complete monthly guide to every program on BBC World Service.
In North America, more than 1 million people tune into the BBC each week. They're passionate about the BBC, and many have been listening for decades. Some of them bought a shortwave radio just to hear the World Service. They prize what the BBC calls the rich mix, a blend of news, drama, documentary, and music programs. Earlier this month, the North American relay stations began airing this message.
From July the 1st, we'll be discontinuing shortwave to North America. The majority of our listeners now hear us via our growing number of FM partners, by satellite, cable, and of course the Internet. And we'll be on new digital radio services later this year. The money we save by closing our shortwave to North America will help us invest in new technologies, which will improve audibility for listeners all over the world.
If you look at what has been happening to our audiences over the last 6 years or so, that really explains the decision.
Jerry Timmons is head of the Americas for the BBC World Service. He says BBC audience research shows rapid growth in their non-shortwave audience, 2.5 million via FM rebroadcasts and 1.5 million over the Internet. At the same time, the shortwave audience has remained stable at just over 1 million. Timmons says that they want to drop shortwave in North America to bolster services elsewhere.
The BBC faces significant investment decisions in shortwave, FM, and online, both in the USA and elsewhere in the world, and we have to cut our cloth to fit those investments.
I don't think that argument holds a lot of water, to be honest.
Ralph Brandy listens to the BBC on shortwave several hours a day. He started a website, SaveBBC.org.
If you look at how much money they're saving on this, it's £500,000 out of a budget of more than 180 million pounds. It's like 1/360th of their budget.
Many listeners feel that the BBC is rushing to embrace new delivery methods and new technology before they're fully in place.
If we could move to FM, we would, but the programs simply aren't there. The FM coverage is so spotty and tends to be overnight, so it's not available at the times when people want to listen. And the internet isn't portable, isn't intimate like radio.
Through one of the marvels of modern science, I am enabled this Christmas Day to speak to all my people throughout the empire, to men and women so cut off by the snows, desert, or the sea, that only voices out of the air can reach them.
That's King George VI delivering his 1932 Christmas address to his subjects over the newly launched Empire Service, the precursor to the World Service. Sir John Reith started the Empire Service to link the British colonies together, and also to counter other voices in the air, notably propaganda broadcasts from Italy and Germany. The BBC featured regular newscasts and saturated the airwaves with British culture. The BBC broadcasts in 43 languages, including English. The Foreign Language Services began in 1938 with Arabic. They added French, German, and Italian as World War II began to unfold.
London calling in the home, overseas, and European services of the BBC and through United Nations Radio Mediterranean.
John Figliozzi writes about international broadcasting for Monitoring Times.
World War II was the seminal moment where people turned to the BBC as the authoritative voice of what was going on in the world. And I think that carried over with, you know, crises that took place afterwards.
Early this morning, the Soviet troops launched a general attack on Hungary. For the sake of God and freedom, help Hungary!
The reason for existence for international broadcasting after the Second World War was the Cold War. The free world had free flow of information. The communist world was controlled information. The BBC had that role, as well as other international broadcasters, in trying to punch through that Iron Curtain.
Around me, scores of people have arrived, being held back by the police, to watch this first incision into the Berlin Wall.
After the Cold War ended, the BBC and other international broadcasters struggled to redefine themselves. Over the past 10 years, more staff have come from commercial radio, and the sound of the BBC has changed. Some signature sounds, like Big Ben, have all but disappeared. Very narrowly focused programs like Farming World and On the Move about transportation have been dropped, and their subjects folded into more general shows. And increasingly, like other international broadcasters, they're seeking to place their programming on other media. Jerry Timmons is head of the Americas for the BBC World Service.
I'd love to have hung on to the shortwave for a bit longer, but the reality is that we have investment decisions to make. You have to balance the overall long-term gain against the short-term pain of losing some services.
Once the North American relay transmitters are cut off, veteran shortwave listener Don Mussel says he'll miss the pleasures of plucking the BBC out of the air.
I have a shortwave radio in the car, and there are large stretches of the country, especially in the Mountain West, where there's just basically nothing to listen to. And it's so nice to be able to punch up the shortwave side and key into one of the BBC transmitters, and I guess I'm going to miss that.
For On the Media, this is David Gorin.
See why the stars choose Motorola TVs.
See the beautiful cabinet style.
Filtered clear pictures.
Dependable chassis.
Hear the golden voice sound.
Be sure to see
Motorola TV.
Cabinet styles and dependable chassis were a big selling point in the early days of television, but soon America was ready for something a little more colorful. The black and white era began to fade 50 years ago next week. Joining me is Marshall Fisher, co-author of Tube, The History of Television. Marshall, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So the reason why we're doing this interview is because Monday is the 50th anniversary of June 25th, 1951, when CBS premiered its color broadcasting system with an evening of television featuring Ed Sullivan, among others. But is this really the date of the first color broadcast?
Well, I suppose it is, except that no one could see that broadcast. So, in fact, June 25th is not quite the important date, although late June of 1951 is still an important week. What happened was on June 25th, CBS did have Ed Sullivan and a lot of their other black and white TV stars put on this hour-long gala premiere. The problem was that what CBS was using was a color technology which was not compatible with black and white. So, although there were 12 million television sets out there, only about a dozen of those 12 million sets could actually pick up the broadcast, and those were at special studio parties. Later that very week, as it happens, RCA, their bitter competitor, they gave a demonstration of their color system, which was compatible.
And behind the RCA system was one man, one rather megalomaniacal, passionate man named David Sarnoff, who was also, RCA also owned the NBC network.
Yes.
His system was compatible, but an early test proved it to be, at least at the beginning, far inferior, right?
Yeah, well, actually, Sarnoff, although he was completely monomaniacal about beating out CBS for colored television, also was trying to delay color television in general. What he wanted to do was get the full marketing or profit potential out of black and white before he got color going. CBS, even though they had an incompatible system, one that could not be seen on black and white sets, they declared they had commercial quality color television. Therefore, that forced Sarnoff to come out and demonstrate his system, which really wasn't quite ready.
But Sarnoff was determined to have the RCA system prevail, and then fortunately the Korean War intervened,
yes,
which gave him time to do just that.
It gave Sarnoff time to get his labs really working and perfect their system, and the FCC kept flip-flopping. By the time the Korean War ended, they flipped again and said that it was the RCA system that should prevail, and by then that was the correct decision. I mean, the RCA system was far superior.
Ultimately, Sarnoff was right. In 1954, however, he predicted that 75,000 sets would be sold, and only 5,000 sets were.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the parlance of our times, what Sarnoff needed, what RCA needed, was a killer app to give people a reason to buy the set. What was the killer app for color television?
I suppose it was when RCA acquired a black and white program, which was called something like the Walt Disney Hour or something. And they decided to produce it in color. In 1960, they premiered Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. And that became a huge show. And in fact, 1960 was the year where RCA recorded their first profit from color TV.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Marshall Fisher is the co-author of Tube, the Invention of Television.
George really does know something about television.
Oh, I've been doing a bit of reading on it. I figure it's going to be a big thing one of these days. Naturally, I want to know all I can about it.
Well, that's the right spirit. Lots of people thought radio was an overnight fad. Wouldn't amount to anything. But look at it today.
Coming up, the case against Survivor. One former castaway is suing the show for faking it. The media flunks out when assessing the NBA presidency and searching for new angles on wedding cakes.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Producers of reality television should have known better than to maroon a corporate lawyer. Now ex-Survivor castaway and attorney Stacey Stillman is suing CBS for fixing the game, She says other contestants were pressured by the show's producers to vote her off the island. It's all reminiscent of the old quiz show scandals of the 50s, in particular the game 21, in which the perspiring and ethnic Herb Stempel was asked to throw the match in favor of the reassuringly waspy Charles Van Doren. Bob Thompson is the head of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University. Bob, how did America react to the quiz show scandals? This was, after all, the earliest days of television.
Everybody, of course, knew by common sense that this was wrong, that this was somehow betraying the American public. And this really was, the quiz show scandal, the fall from grace of American television, which seemed to have so much promise before that.
But nobody seems to see the survivor case as a fall from grace. Does Stacey Stillman even have a case?
Well, it all depends on whether or not Stacey Stillman was really voted off that island by some kind of consortium of power that included the producer and other people. And if that's the case, that would be a fraud according to those quiz show laws.
On the other hand, former FCC Chairman Reed Hunt, he says the cheesy nature of so-called reality TV does not dignify regulatory intervention. There's nothing more hoked up than the fundamental premise of Survivor. So why should you regard any of it as remotely similar to reality?
He may be right. Yes, it's cheesy. Yes, it's a lot of the things he said. But nevertheless, for all of its cheesiness, these things still are presenting themselves as games where contestants win money, which is exactly what those quiz shows were before. And if, in fact, it turns out that they were manipulated, that is not different from what happened in the quiz show scandal. And that is very much the purview of a regulatory commissions. When I hear those kinds of statements where he's essentially saying these programs are so stupid, we don't need to regulate them because no one would believe they were true. Well, I don't know if he ever watched some of the quiz shows back then, like Dotto and Tic-Tac-Doe. They were pretty stupid, too.
It seems to me that Reed Hunt has his finger on the pulse of the American zeitgeist here, if you can forgive that mixed metaphor, because the fact is that no one seems to be particularly interested in this lawsuit. There's been little press coverage. There have been hardly any late show jokes.
The reason I don't think we're hearing a lot about it is it's interesting how this has been packaged as such that most people are looking at Stacey and Dirk and simply saying, oh, they're sore losers. They got voted off. They're upset about it, and they want to continue their exposure and their possibility of getting money as a result of it. I think up until now, most people don't care about the kind of manipulation that goes up to the vote, and most of them don't believe that the vote was in fact manipulated in the first place. If that came out with smoking gun kind of evidence, I think then the comedians would jump on board, then the public outcry would happen.
Well, back in the days of the quiz shows, it didn't seem like Herb Stempel was the victim, although he was the complainant. It seemed like the American people were the victims there.
I think to look at the participants here as the victims is probably the wrong way to look at it. I think it is the idea that the audience is presumably being presented with something that is one thing, and it turns out to be something else. They're watching this show for a lot of reasons, including its cheesy nature, including the excitement of a different kind of a genre. And let's face it, Survivor was a really good, rip-roaring show. It was fun to watch, and one of the reasons why Survivor was better than Big Brother was that they did take the care to reshoot scenes, to be cinematically perfect. We've been the beneficiaries to be entertained by this show, partially because they've pulled some of these sorts of things.
Does that somehow appear to be giving license to television producers to lie if it builds ratings?
There's a really disturbing calculus developing now, which is the idea now that it's almost assumed that television is filled with fraudulent claims, over-exaggerations, that it lies to us constantly, that in fact what we're hearing happened on Survivor, if it in fact happened, would just be business as usual. I don't think the FCC or the Justice Department or anybody else can let that line of reasoning go. If this kind of stuff is going on, I don't think you can simply say, well, you know, everybody's been doing this. What is the big deal? This would be like if you charge someone for murder and they would say, well, you know, I've been doing that every week all my life. So what? Why are you bugging me about it now?
Thanks a lot, Bob.
My pleasure.
Bob Thompson is director of the Center for the Study of Popular Television at Syracuse University.
CEO-in-Chief, the MBA President. Much has been made of President Bush's corporate model of management and the fact that he is the first U.S. president with a master's in business administration. But the media's infatuation with the president's Harvard cred is not shared by the corporate cognoscenti, according to On the Media's John Solomon, who, by the way, graduated from Harvard Business School 16 years after the president.
This spring, a New York Times front page headline trumpeted, "Bush providing corporate model. Staff knows to look sharp, speak fast, poll less, and spare him the details." A recent Arizona Republic editorial also tapped what has become a popular metaphor. Adults in charge at the White House, MBA style works.
It's surprising that the political writers seem to know so little about the business community.
Quinn Mills has been teaching management at Harvard Business School for 25 years. He admits to being more than a little perplexed of late by the media's constant invocation of President Bush's so-called corporate model and MBA style.
Well, I think there's a good bit of surprise in the community of faculty and students at Harvard, at the business school, and at other business schools, at the kind of a characterization that the media makes of corporate leadership when they talk about the president in that context.
Rob Walker, the business columnist for Slate.com, says that the corporate model highlighted in the Times piece this spring would not have been recognized in most U.S. boardrooms. Walker adds that when it comes to coverage of Bush's management approach, much of the media is 50 years out of step.
I don't think that you would find many of the CEOs that we're sort of most impressed with endorsing the ideas that were set out there as being evidence of the Bush corporate style. They were basing their argument largely on the dress code that had been introduced in the White House and a new emphasis on punctuality at meetings and that sort of thing.
As business has become such a big story over the past decade, and most White House reporters work for large corporations, the press's superficial understanding of corporate life is surprising. But it seems as if that lack of knowledge has clearly worked to Bush's advantage, because business is hot. It's seen as the engine of America's international preeminence, and the businessman has become a mainstream societal hero.
Generally, even in this kind of a post-bubble environment, I think people have pretty good feelings about how corporations are run and that they're efficient and they're competitive and they get things done, and that stands in contrast to the way we think, the shorthand of the way we think about government, which we always think of as being sort of, you know, endlessly bumbling and caught up in red tape and bureaucracy and never really getting to the bottom line.
When I entered business school at the end of the 1980s, MBAs were portrayed in the media as narrow-minded and money-obsessed at best and unethical at worst. There once would have been widespread doubts about a business degree's suitability to politics, or that a graduate could be trusted as the ultimate custodian of the public good. As they might say at Harvard, consumer attitudes have changed. But Professor Mills warns that the MBA-in-chief tag has the potential for damaging Bush's image if he doesn't live up to reporters' ideas of a corporate administration.
One thing they might say is that we said this guy, this president, was more businesslike, but he isn't. The White House is confused. It has too many different sources of power. They conflict with one another. It's not being coordinated. No large company would operate this way.
On the other hand, Mills says Bush might also be criticized for choosing an inappropriate leadership model for his government job.
And in fact, the whole problem arises out of the fact that he's trying to be a businessman where he really ought to be the president of the United States.
While emphasizing the strengths of the Harvard MBA training, the media has so far undercovered the fact that the B school may have reinforced some of the president's potentially problematic management traits. Ironically, for someone often chided for not being a good student, Bush may have learned his lessons almost too well. Harvard tells you to figure out what you do well and delegate the rest. Not to overthink, but not to rely solely on the thinking of others. The press has yet to look into whether he is taking his MBA precepts to an inappropriate extreme. If they knew more about business, according to Professor Mills, reporters would realize that the MBA president's operation is not so different from that of his predecessor, the Juris Doctor president.
I view the Clinton White House and the Bush White House as a lot more like each other than either one of them was really like the headquarters of a large corporation.
Getting beyond misplaced and played-out MBA metaphors will be important when the time comes for shareholders to vote on whether to extend the contract of the CEO-in-chief. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
Generally speaking, the editors at, say, Newsweek don't have a problem coming up with story ideas. They look back a week and rehash the news. If that doesn't suggest a cover story, they can always explain all-world religion or terrorism or Britney Spears. But some editors haven't the luxury afforded by random events. Golfing, hunting, karate, beauty, fitness. Specialty publications, not news-driven, have to generate stories relying solely on their own editorial imaginations, while basically covering the same material again and again and again.
I was thinking, obviously, our average reader doesn't have a trainer all the time.
Right.
But if we could do some kind of comparison where we have three women or four women start a six-week regimen,
We're trying to do it. It's sort of.
This is the story meeting at Fitness, the women's magazine of body, mind, and spirit, and things are a little tense. Every story suggested seems so been done already.
There's something there, but I don't think.
What if you throw diet into the mix and say, you know, maybe they all want to lose.
Like different
20
tactics,
pounds or something.
Right.
And one
totally
person tries
tactics.
Diet alone, one person tries exercise alone, and then another person has both.
But we tell people all the time that you need both.
One by one, the staffers pitch ideas, and one by one, gently, Editor-in-Chief Emily Listfield shoots them down. But in time, the magazine will be filled because, Listfield explains, it's just a question of tuning into the readers.
It's just listening to women talk. And when you listen to women talk, you get a million ideas. There's something new every day that they're curious about.
The problem is that curiosity is limited to very few spheres of human existence. For instance, in the June issue, the cover boasted a 30-minute thigh sculpting workout, whereas in May, it was a better butt in 10 minutes, and in July, it was the breakthrough workout to burn fat all day long. Fitness, of course, is for women. A men's health magazine has concerns far different from feminine body obsession. Steve Perrine is the editorial creative director of Men's Health.
Women tend to be self-conscious about their thighs and their butts, and men tend to be self-conscious about their stomachs.
So hence, in July, the fastest ab plan ever. In June, you had a story, 10 greatest ab exercises ever. May, all-star abs. October, find your abs. September, machine-built abs. A lot of ab stories.
Well, some of the stories are part of plans that we put together, which guys can follow month to month. Others are very particular, interesting takes. For example, the All-Star Abs, what we did is we picked a bunch of athletes and celebrities who are in particularly great shape, and we had them give us their workouts.
Celebrity abs. Nice touch. Both editors insist their magazines offer fresh takes on the kinds of issues most important to their readers. In fact, according to John Fine, my advertising age colleague on the magazine beat, readers may want nothing more from their glossies than a game effort to wrap familiar material in new packages. Because whether the category is beauty or fitness or golf, these magazines tend to be feeding fantasies in the first place.
There's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to, you know, golf a 72. I mean, there's always the hope that in 6 months, you know, you're going to drop 20 pounds and, you know, put on 15 pounds of lean body weight. But, I mean, if you're looking at it really obsessively, there's an infinite amount of variation. There's an infinite amount of ways you can talk about it. I mean, if you think about any real dedicated hobbyist, I mean, they sound like they're repeating themselves a lot. And, you know, maybe they are. Maybe there's a certain comfort in doing that. There's a sense of, like, returning to something that's important to them. It becomes, I don't know, like a song that you listen to over and over again.
Or maybe, in its endless superficial variation on theme, like pornography. Or maybe another vice altogether.
To me, instruction editorial is the heroine of golf magazines. It may make you feel good for a moment, but it really kills creativity in the publication, I think.
John Atwood is editor-in-chief of Travel and Leisure Golf, a magazine that prides itself on transcending the five tips for mastering the sand wedge sort of material that fills its competition month after month. We visited his editorial meeting, too, and found a magazine with content bounded only by the limitations of its travel budget.
I got a query from a guy. What the hell was that story? Oh, Ireland. On one of our trips last year, we used the services of a helicopter company, and that seems to be becoming the preferred mode of transportation around Ireland. So, you know, given who our audience is, I think we need to do something on that topic.
The Irish helicopter tour was such a fetching subject, in fact, that Travel and Leisure Golf had done it already in the current issue. No problem for coming issues, though. There are many other countries and several other modes of transportation. Editors such as Atwood have one sort of challenge, interesting essentially the same audience month after month. Diane Forden of Bridal Guide magazine has the opposite problem, interesting an ever-changing pool of readers without boring herself right out of her skull. Her readership turns over every 6 to 14 months.
So that's the creative challenge, especially when you work for a bridal magazine, is how do we keep this material fresh? How do we keep it relevant? How do we, you know, get the reader excited, keep ourselves excited?
But every month she has to do a wedding gown story, and every month she has to do a wedding planning story, and every month she has to do a cake story.
We don't want to photograph the same type of cake story. I think once we did a cake for all seasons, so it was different wedding cakes for your seasons. We didn't want to repeat that, but we still wanted to present an idea of showing wonderful wedding cakes, but what was our theme? What was our idea? We know we repeat ourselves, yes, but we always give it a new twist, a new angle.
It's all about angles. At the Fitness magazine meeting, one editor proposed a very unexpected piece for a publication focusing on positive self-image. It was about a clinically depressed cheerleading coach. And that story may well be assigned, too, provided they can stay in tune with their readers and come up with, you know, an upbeat angle. The editorial process at these magazines is about 10% journalism and 90% geometry.
Everybody's always doing look great naked. I really like the idea of feel great naked. 50 Reasons to Love Your Body.
50 Reasons to Love Your Body. Splendid idea. Next month, 51 Reasons to Love Your Body. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers, engineered by George Edwards, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sean Landis, Kathleen Horan, and Horacio Nigro.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Goodbye.
Funding for On the Media is provided by the Ford Foundation, the Florence and John Schumann Foundation, the Bidell Foundation, the John T. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This program is a production of WNYC Radio New York. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.